This is a production of Cornell University.
Totally exhausted from that introduction, I must say. But it's true, as I was saying to Bud when I met him at the airport, and he asked me why I'm doing all these things all at once, it's because it is the beginning of the Lincoln bicentennial season. It only comes once every 200 years. I don't expect to do the tricentennial, so this is the moment. And we've got events planned for throughout the country, a big Lincoln's birthday event in Washington on February 12th. Everything will be televised, and it's very exciting. And publishers want new books on Lincoln, so I'm happy to oblige. This is probably the worst marketing moment for me to speak on the subject that I chose for tonight, because I'm literally between projects. So part of my talk tonight is going to be about a book that's 3 years old, and that's not supposed to be a smart thing to do. And the other part of the talk is about a book that you can't get yet because it's not coming out until October 24th, and that's supposed to be an even dumber thing to do. But I know you all have great memories, and you'll remember the book, Lincoln, President-elect. I'll mention it a few more times during the evening. It also seemed appropriate to talk about Lincoln in a presidential election context. Obviously, we are all embroiled in observing one of the most exciting presidential campaigns that has occurred in this country in 50 years. And I dare say it was very much like that in 1860. And it's worth thinking about that and thinking about the parallels and then perhaps thinking about the outcome and what Lincoln has to face. So that was the idea for tonight. But to appreciate the 1860 campaign, you really have to imagine yourself in a political culture that is totally vanished. A culture in which politicians were routinely considered great heroes, where people kept pictures of politicians on their walls, the way people keep sports figures on posters on their walls today, or rock stars on their, you know, their computers as the opening image. What do you call that image again? Screensaver, thank you. I have to get that right because it's not good enough to say sports posters anymore. You have to get with the program. And obviously, there was no 24-hour news. Yet there was a barrage of information and an intense curiosity about politics. Politics was the only group activity that people had besides church and the state or county fair. It was the thing that brought people together for rallies, for events. And it was so all-encompassing that the only newspapers that existed in the country were completely partisan newspapers. I know we demand that our journalists be nonpartisan today, but that was exactly the opposite of what they were supposed to be. The newspapers were run by political parties and political bosses. They were expected to toe the party line. How anyone ever changed parties, I can't imagine, because they were reading their party newspapers. Into this culture came Abraham Lincoln. And we know that he made an enormous impression during his debates with Senator Stephen Douglas, that he was smart enough to challenge him, to engage him in. He asked for 40, he settled for 7, and they were reprinted throughout the country and made him something of an overnight sensation. Nevertheless, as 1859 came around and he had lost the actual Senate election, which was decided by the state legislature of Illinois in those days, until the 20th century, legislatures decided on senators, not popular vote. And he enters 1859, everyone thinks, not really thinking about the presidency. I disagree. I think Lincoln was thinking about the presidency from the time he was about 30 years old. I've never met a politician who achieved major success who wasn't thinking in very ambitious terms from an astonishingly early age. I've met some who were terribly disappointed or who disappointed us, but they all thought about it. The modesty factor is great for your image, but it doesn't really it's not really a legitimate factor in the development of these people's personalities. Anyway, in 1859, Abraham Lincoln was a practicing lawyer. He had to go back to work as a lawyer. He had no money. He actually had a few campaign debts from the Senate race. And he was in a town called Clinton, Illinois, on October 15th, 1859, out of a case that he won. And he's given a dinner that night. And during the dinner, the fellow Republicans who were with him receive and analyze the returns of major elections that are taking place in the country, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, and in Wisconsin. States where Lincoln had gone out and stumped for Republicans. States that he thought, should they go Republican, would be a very good omen and a good harbinger for the 1860 campaign. He had campaigned personally in some of those states for Republicans. And so he must have been very pleased when he received the news that Republicans had really emerged quite triumphantly from these state elections. Why October 15th? Because until the 20th century, there were elections all the time, by the way. There were something like 40 major elections during the Civil War alone, not just the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. So this was an important vote. And then Lincoln goes home back to Springfield, Illinois, on the train. I don't know what's percolating in his mind. We don't need to imagine too much, because when he gets home, he walks alone to his house. And if he's like most of us when we travel, the first thing I would suspect that he would do is check his mail. He'd been away for 2 weeks. His wife is keeping his mail, one imagines, on one table in the parlor. And if we know Mary, she was wise enough to put the one telegram he got at the top of the pile. Telegrams are the most important communications, right? And he opens this telegram, and it says, "Will you lecture in Brooklyn, B-R-O-O-L-Y-N, Brooklyn." It was so alien to the telegraph operator in Springfield that he didn't even get it right when he wrote, when he transcribed the message. $200 honorarium and expenses. And the venue was the Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, one of the shrines to anti-slavery in the country, Henry Ward Beecher's church, still standing, still open to the public if you're in Brooklyn. And Lincoln read this, and I think immediately leaped into a new mode in his planning and in his estimation of his own future. He had never spoken publicly in New York City, which was then, as now, the media capital of the country. He never really had major speaking engagements in the East. He was famous as a Western orator, but if he was to really contend for the nomination for the presidency, he had to prove himself in the East, something he'd never done. So he negotiated with his hosts. "I'll come if I can come at the end of your lecture series." It was a series of lectures. "And I'll come if I can speak on politics." Now, Lincoln had always wanted a lecture. Lecturing was a side light of his: politics, the law, and a third career in lecturing, which is not very well known. But in those days, you proved your intellectual bona fides by doing these pedantic lectures in town. And he developed a lecture on discoveries and inventions, which is probably the worst speech that he ever made, wrote, delivered, and he would never stop. He delivered it 5 or 6 times, charging 25 cents admission. Once he did so badly that he gave back the 25 cents to the people. So he loved the idea of lecturing, but he was too smart to go to New York and lecture on discoveries and inventions, politics. The lecture was organized by a group called the Young Men's Central Republican Union. The remarkable thing is that the members weren't very young. Some of them were, not many. It was organized, now this is going to sound very much like New York to all of you, organized by a group that hated its own Senator William Seward. You know, we all still have upstate, downstate tensions. These guys were downstaters, and they hated Seward because he was from Auburn, you know, so he wasn't one of them. Moreover, they rationalized it by saying, Seward's the favorite to win the nomination this in Chicago and run for president. But if he runs, he may get all the votes from Easterners, but he's never going to get any votes from Westerners because he's an Easterner. He's gone on record saying we're going to have a conflict over slavery. He's too radical. Let's find other people. So they planned this lecture series, and they invited all of these great orators from the West, Cassius Marcellus Clay, Thomas Corwin of Ohio, Salmon P. Chase, who later became Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury. You may remember that name from Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. But he had he was so tone-deaf politically that he turned them down. History might have been different had he gone. So Lincoln goes, he agrees to go, and he then has to decide what will he lecture about. Political. You know who came to his rescue? His lifetime opponent, Stephen A. Douglas. Stephen A. Douglas published an article in Harper's Magazine called The Dividing Line. Now, for Douglas to be in a liberal Republican paper was a shock that upset Lincoln to begin with. Moreover, Douglas used the article to make the case that the founding fathers of this country believed that the federal government would never have the power to restrict slavery, that that power would always remain with states and localities. And he did research. He had his senatorial assistants do research. The great American historian George Bancroft helped him with the piece. Lincoln was furious. Well, he decided he would devote his speech at Beecher's Church in Brooklyn, to refuting this argument, to proving, because this was his whole argument at the time, slavery can't spread. The federal government should stop the spread of slavery, and that's the way to kill it. Contain it, and it'll die. So Lincoln did his own research on this subject. And I think that part of it is pretty astonishing. He read all the debates that took place at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He read the debates that took place in the state ratification conventions. He read a book called Commentaries on the Constitution. He read the Dictionary of Congress. He read the Congressional Record. He decided that he would choose as his founding fathers the people who signed the Constitution and find out how they believed, how they voted in subsequent years, what they said publicly, if they became senators or congressmen, how they voted on this subject of federal control. He read and he read, and he believed that he convinced himself that 20 of the 27 signers whose work could be examined had believed that the federal government could indeed restrict slavery. And this was a revelation to him, because Douglas had written, "Our fathers knew best." Well, he was going to go to New York and make the case that Douglas had lied. It wasn't easy to get to. I thought I had a tough time getting to Ithaca today, but we're so spoiled, right? Lincoln traveled 1,400 miles on about 5 different railroads over 3 days from Springfield, Illinois to New York City. Well, actually to Jersey City, because there was no railroad into the city. And just before he's ready to leave, his wife presents him with a knitted hat that she's knitted because it's cold in the cars. This is February. A beautiful box lunch. Isn't she a wonderful wife? And she says, "One more thing. My cousin, whose name is Mrs. Smith, her husband is looking for work in Illinois. She's got nowhere to go. She needs to go back to her people who live in Philadelphia. Why don't you let her go with you as far as Philadelphia, which is, you know, 3/4 of the trip? And take her 2-year-old son, Dudley." Can you imagine what that trip was like? From Springfield to Philadelphia, no sleeper cars, no dining cars, and a 2-year-old boy. And Lincoln is, as he always does, looking at that manuscript, handwritten, 7,500 words, handwritten manuscript, studying it. Well, he finally, by the way, press is so unkind that when Lincoln gets to Indianapolis, the Democratic newspaper writes an item that says, "Mr. Lincoln has just passed through town with a woman who says her name is Mrs. Smith." The press was tough. After the end of the journey, he gets to Jersey City. He then takes a ferry across the Hudson River, filled with tourists, visitors, animals, horses, carriages, lands in a ferry slip in the shadow of where the World Trade Center stood, walked to Broadway, took a left turn, walked a couple of blocks, and registered at the Astor House Hotel, which was the grandest hotel in New York City at that time. Sort of fading a little bit, but pretty grand. Right opposite City Hall, which still stands, right opposite the big newspapers of the day, the Tribune, the Times, and right opposite Barnum's Garish Museum, and a block away from Trinity Church, which still stands. He registers, and again, I'm placing myself in his boots, which is presumptuous, I know. First thing I do when I get to a new city is I buy the local paper, you know, probably for the same reason he did, to see if he's in it. And he was in it. It said, Abraham Lincoln to speak tomorrow, a Monday night, this is a Saturday, at Cooper Institute in New York. He had no clue that he was speaking at what is later became Cooper Union. He came all the way to New York with a speech that he designed to be read in a church. The myth that they moved it to Cooper Union because it was bigger is not true, because it's very simple mathematically, Plymouth Church holds more people. Fact is, he delayed going for so long that the lecture series was over that was being held at the church, and they simply booked Cooper Union. If you're ever in New York City, you must visit, and you're interested in this period, which I'm sure you are or you wouldn't be here, you should go to see Cooper Union, celebrating its 150th birthday next year. It was brand new, and it was a sort of a crazy place. For one thing, it had night classes. It had classes for men and women, so that made it an unusual institution of higher learning. It also had a museum and a sort of a museum of stuffed animals in the attic. And it's an interesting ringer someone has. And it had an auditorium for 1,400 people in the basement. Peter Cooper, who the industrialist who gave the money for the place, thought that fires were so prevalent in auditoriums that it would be much safer for people to run away upstairs than downstairs. And that's why the Great Hall is in the basement. Anyway. So Lincoln gets to New York. He goes, he reads that he's going to be at Cooper Union. He also has to go to Beecher's Church because every tourist to New York, every VIP tourist, goes to Beecher's Church. They do two things. They go to the Five Points, which you probably saw exaggerated in the movie Gangs of New York, which was the worst slum in the United States. And you went to Beecher's Church to hear a sermon. So on Sunday, he took the Fulton Street Ferry. He went over to Beecher's Church. He heard Henry Ward Beecher. People didn't know quite what to make of him because he was taller than everybody else, you know, sitting right in the front. His pew is still marked there. He also was heard grunting, I guess, in the old-fashioned Baptist way whenever Beecher made a point. People would hear him going, So they thought, this guy is, you know, he's a little strange. But then he goes back to New York, and he has to work on the speech because, as he put it, he didn't prepare it for a secular audience, prepared it for church. I don't know how many times he revised it, how he revised a 7,500-word speech at the last minute. I'll explain why we don't know in a minute. And then on Monday morning, with work still to be done, there's a knock on his hotel room door, and it's the Young Republicans themselves. They say, are you ready for your tour of Broadway? Which I'm sure he also didn't know he was getting. They march him up from City Hall to Greenwich Village, looking at all the signs and walking through all the mud and buying a hat for himself. There's no record that he bought anything for his family, you know, just his own hat at Knox Hat Makers. And he goes to 10th Street, to the studio of the great photographer Matthew Brady, where according to the records, he's ushered into the studio. It's interesting, Victorian gentlemen never said, I really need to have my picture taken to illustrate and commemorate this event because it just wasn't done. You had to be ushered in or importuned in because they had to be modest about their image. Well, he was in, and he gets to Brady's, goes up to the second floor to the gallery, and Matthew Brady takes one look at him and realizes he has a challenge. First of all, the neck brace that has to immobilize his head doesn't reach to his neck. So they have to pile boxes on the floor. You know, it looks like a music stand. So the tripod bottom is on boxes and the neck brace is there. Brady makes a brilliant decision. He decides not to do a close-up portrait of Abraham Lincoln. His skin is bad. He has moles. He has warts. He has, someone once wrote he had skin that looked as if it had been scarred by acid. So Brady moved the camera back and decided that what he wanted to record is Lincoln from the waist up. Heroic, because this is one of the biggest people he's ever seen. He's massive. He's 6'4" in a day when the average man is 5'4". And at the last minute, Brady says, "Mr. Lincoln, would you please pull up your collar?" And Lincoln says, "Ah, I see you want to shorten my neck." And Brady says, "That's it exactly." So Lincoln tugs up his collar. That totem pole of a neck with a big Adam's apple is concealed. Brady clicks the shutter, and the result is, in image terms, as monumental an effort as the Cooper Union was in literary terms. That picture becomes Lincoln's campaign image. It's sent all across the country in prints and posters and banners. And it's particularly important because it'll represent him, as I'll get to in a second. Finally, at 7 o'clock, he takes a streetcar. There are about 1,500 people in the auditorium out of 2,000. Lots of competition in New York in those days. Singers, equestrian shows. Laura Keene, the actress, was appearing just across the street. She's the actress who was on stage when Lincoln was assassinated, or in the play. She wasn't actually on stage. He starts out, "Mr. Chairman," and there is a reporter in the front row who jots down, "Old man, this will never do. This is New York." His gait is strange. His feet are enormous. His pants are too short. He's bought a new $100 suit before leaving Springfield, but he wore it on the 3-day trip. So he looks a little bit rumpled. But after 10 or 15 minutes, he has the audience in the palm of his hand. His gestures begin to correlate more with the words. He begins to make this ringing argument that the founders of the country indeed believed that the federal government had the power to restrict slavery. And then he changes course and speaks directly to Southerners and says, "We don't want to break up this union. We don't even want to touch your slaves necessarily. We simply want to stop the spread of this injustice and stop the spread of this institution and put slavery on the course of ultimate extinction, which is what the founding fathers really wanted." And then, this is about an hour and a half into this speech, he changes course one more time and speaks, as he says, a few words to Republicans and ends with that famous peroration, "Let us have faith that might makes right, and in that faith let us dare to do our duty as we understand it." And the audience erupts. People stand up and cheer. Again, remember the culture. These are people who've come out because they love politics. They're all Republicans, men and women. They thought Lincoln was a curiosity. And boy, did he work hard that night. The other myth that the crowd was small because of a snowfall is not true. I found meteorological records that show that it was almost 60 degrees. And if any of you are as old enough as I am to remember going to school, public schools or any schools, in the days when they would turn on the boiler on November 1st and then they would leave it on. If you had Indian summer, it was too bad. They can't stoke it down. It was on all the time. That place must have been totally unbearable. Bud mentioned Sam Waterston. We did the Cooper Union address on its anniversary at Cooper Union. And he did a 70-minute version because he used the microphone. Lincoln, of course, spoke more slowly because he didn't use the microphone. And he spoke very slowly anyway. Waterston was completely drenched in sweat when it was over and had consumed the giant size of one of these. It's a tough thing to do. That kind of orating where you have to project way to the back of the room. Lincoln even had a friend of his from Springfield who he didn't expect to be there. He said, "Sit in the back, and if I'm not speaking loud enough, hold your hat on a cane and wave it back and forth, I'll know I have to project more. It was never needed, but that's what he arranged. Lincoln's day was not over at the end of that speech. To show you how much people loved speeches, when the speech was done, there were three or four more speeches. The commissioner of police spoke. The host spoke. People didn't want to leave. I mean, there was no rush to the parking lot, not just for the obvious reasons, but because when people committed to go out at night to see a political event, they expected it to go on for 4 hours, 5 hours. It was part of the culture. And he sat through all those speeches. Then they took the poor guy to a dinner at a private club, the young Republicans. We don't know how long it lasted, but we know that when Lincoln was finally put on a streetcar back to go down Broadway, the host noticed that he was limping. And they asked if he was all right, and he said, "It's just that I bought new boots to go on this trip." A good lesson to politicians: never make a big speech in new shoes. You have to test the shoes first. He didn't go back to his hotel to rest. He went right to the offices of the New York Tribune. By prearrangement, they had gotten the manuscript of the speech and they were setting it in type. Lincoln spoke to 1,400 people that night, but he knew that if he got it into print without mistakes, the way he wanted it, 140,000 would see it the next day. The Tribune, the New York Sun, the New York Times, and the New York Herald, and the New York Post were all going to run it the next day. And Lincoln read two rounds of galleys personally, making whatever hand corrections he had to make. And we know he used to do that because he did it on his first inaugural. We have that record. But we don't have Cooper Union. We don't have any of his pre-presidential speeches because he didn't have a secretary to pick up the leavings. Instead, the tradition was when you're finished with a page of manuscript, you let it sort of drop to the floor and swept up with the rubble. Unless someone who is yet to be identified has the copy, we'll never see it and we'll never know how he constructed it or crossed out words. The next morning when he wakes up, he's been given the biggest rave reviews of his career. He has absolutely become the toast of New York. And then, listening to summonses that he had received that night and the night before and the day before that, he goes on a speaking tour to Providence, Rhode Island, to four venues in New Hampshire, Hartford, Connecticut, New Haven, three other cities in Connecticut, and does reiterations of the Cooper Union address with a side trip to see his son who is at Phillips Exeter Academy. And he gets his honorarium when he's with his son. They say, "We wish it could have been $2,000 instead of $200. They didn't offer him $2,000, but they said they wished it could have been. Why is this trip important? Because by the time Lincoln comes back and heads back to Springfield, a new person in the political pantheon, having successfully conquered the East, that is effectively the end of Abraham Lincoln's campaign for president. It's March 5th or 6th when he gets back to Springfield. He does nothing else politically. One more iteration of that old Discoveries and Inventions lecture. Nothing else. May comes around, and he wins the nomination for the presidency. There is no convention speech. There's no speech in the Denver football stadium. There's no speech in the convention hall. He gets a letter that says what he already knows by telegraph: you're the nominee. He receives a little delegation from the Chicago convention that comes in and says, "Here's your official notification. Will you accept?" And he says, "I accept." And that's it. Can you imagine a presidential campaign where there is basically from May until November, not a word from the candidates? How many people would... No, we won't do that. I've been saying that for 3 years, and people like roar, but now it's sort of fun. I must admit, this year is sort of fun. But it's long, isn't it? Then it was merciful. It was May to November, and the campaign, and Cooper Union was the whole campaign. And it's astonishing. That Cooper Union photograph is his surrogate. The Cooper Union speech is his surrogate. It's reprinted by newspapers and pamphlets. It's reprinted in a fancy brochure. It's distributed all over the country. It's printed in German, because German voters are a big part of the Republican electorate. It is enough. Abraham Lincoln is, as you know, elected and transforms himself happily to me into the character that I've written about for the book that's yet to come out, Lincoln President-Elect. And here's another difference. Let me read something that I just took out of the Washington Post on June 11th. It's a column called In the Loop. And the writer, whose name is Al Kamen, writes the following. The Washington chatter is all about whom John McCain and Barack Obama are going to pick as their running mates. But there's another job that both candidates should focus on fairly soon. Transition director. Solid transition planning and initial personnel decisions are simply too important to put off until after the election. Now there's an astonishing difference between 2008 and 1860. Not only did Lincoln not put into place a transition team before the convention or before the election, he didn't have a transition team after the election. Election day comes, and he's suddenly thrust into the most dangerous interregnum in the history of the United States. States begin threatening to secede, and within a few weeks, South Carolina will do so. He has no transition director. He has no transition committee. Senior advisors, well, he has William Seward's senior advisor, Thurlow Weed, the editor of the Albany Argus, who comes to Springfield and advises him on patronage. He is expected to fill about 1,500 federal jobs. He's expected to assemble a cabinet. And as he soon learns from his correspondence, he's expected to shut up. He's expected to say absolutely nothing. He gets letters from influential editors saying, we want nothing from you. We want no comments. Who else does he have? Two United States senators from Illinois. One would think they would be his closest advisors, the way my friend Senator Dick Durbin is a very close advisor to Senator Obama. He's been his supporter from the beginning. Who does Lincoln have? He's got two senators who opposed him. Stephen Douglas, and the other is Lyman Trumbull, who's a Republican, but a Republican who stole a Senate seat from him in 1854. Not too close. He's got the head of the state committee, Orville Browning, who thinks that the Republicans made a mistake in nominating him. He's got the famous jurist, David Davis, who knew how to make an impression. He was 300 pounds in girth. He was a lawyer and a judge who Lincoln had known for 30 years. But as he said, Lincoln never listened to a word of advice he ever gave him. He ultimately named him to the Supreme Court, but that was a few years later. He had a staff of exactly two. John Nicolay, a German-born newspaper editor, and John Hay, a young law student who had gone to Brown University and come back to study law in Springfield, but was recruited as a private secretary. William Osborne Stoddard, who we heard referred to before, wanted very much to be the third secretary and began peppering Lincoln with letters saying, take me, you know, I'm ready to serve, I've worked for you, I've campaigned for you, I was the first newspaper man to editorialize that you should be president. No response. I'm willing to go on a trial basis like the Dutchman took his wife, whatever that means, but the other thing Lincoln never had, Stoddard got a job, we shouldn't worry, and he became a very important character, but it took him quite a few months before Lincoln actually hired him. No security. Lincoln got the most outrageous threats against his person, threats of poison, threats of castration, threats of, you know, the vilest kinds of things, and they saved most of these letters, the secretaries. And he was fearful, I think. He even thought maybe I should be, for a small period of time, he actually entertained the idea of being sworn in as president in Springfield, Illinois, and then traveling with the army to Washington. But he finally rejected the idea as one that would smack of cowardice. Then he thought of Seward wanted him to come to Washington early without telling anyone and get to the Capitol. He rejected that too. He had another challenge that we never think about, but that was unique to this period. Lincoln actually had to be elected three times, not once. And in all three times, the result was open to question. He only won 39% of the popular vote on election day. He did win a majority of electoral votes. But he immediately believed that there would be a problem on the day that the electoral votes were counted in the states, December 5th. He thought it was a point of great danger. It came off well. Then he believed that February 15th was a dangerous day. People have been warning him about the dangers of going in an open carriage to your inauguration. And he thought that the real point of danger was February 15th when the electoral vote was actually counted. Several reasons. Some southern states had already withdrawn from the Union. So what would constitute a quorum of the Electoral College? Would it be the entire country, or would it be the states who were still pledging allegiance to the country? And how could you say that if you didn't recognize secession? So there was a legal question. There was also a threat that there would be boycotts by the southern states and armed disruption. General Winfield Scott, Virginia-born, hero of the Mexican War, finally assured Lincoln that I will plant cannon on Capitol Hill, and if anyone dares, any senator dares to interrupt the vote, they will be blown to smithereens halfway across the Potomac to Virginia. Again, it came off without a hitch, but it was not a sure thing. What else did Lincoln face that one hopes no president-elect ever faces again? He faced a sitting president, who decided that his wisest course was to just pack very slowly and do very little else. James Buchanan was a piece of work. He believed that the states had no right to secede, but that the federal government had no right to prevent them from seceding. So basically, he tore his hair out and saw his cabinet members resign and held cabinet meetings and prayed for March 4th. It was a longer interregnum than we have. It was from November to March, December, January, February, March, 4 long months. While Buchanan dithered, several efforts were made to create compromise that could prevent or reverse secession. And this was a difficult thing, too, because no one really had any authority to do anything except by constitutional amendment. There was a committee of Congress, committee of the Senate, committee of the House that met to discuss plans to compromise. What was compromise? It actually meant a constitutional amendment that would pledge the government to never interfering with slavery forever and ever and ever, and never allowing laws that would countermand the amendment. It barred the suspension of slavery in the District of Columbia. Lincoln was actually willing, he said, to approve of those measures because he felt they were consistent with his party platform and that he had to show some interest in some compromise or he would be blamed for war, even though I think he never envisioned a war that would take 600,000 lives. What he wouldn't do is extend the Missouri Compromise out west, because that would violate what he'd been fighting against in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, what he had been arguing against at Cooper Union, and that is you cannot allow the extension of slavery. And as he said to senators who were chafing at the bit to compromise, the tug has to come, better now than later. Hold fast like a chain of steel. That's what he said to Congressman Elihu Washburn. Well, he managed to stop this congressional compromise by showing no interest. Then various states decided to start a peace convention to meet at Willard's Hotel in Washington, the site of what is now the Willard, and have a completely separate extra-governmental group create its own compromise plan, very much like the congressional compromise plan. And they found an ex-president of the United States, John Tyler of Virginia, a slaveholder, to head the convention. Did they name him chairman of the convention? No, that would have been too polite. They named him president. So now, for a few months, there are three presidents. There's James Buchanan, there's Abraham Lincoln as president-elect, and there's John Tyler organizing sort of an extra-legal compromise plan. During all this time, Lincoln has to resist compromise because he won't allow the extension of slavery. He has to minimize the attitude of coercion. He can't seem like he's beating down the South because he still believes that the border states will remain loyal to the Union, even Virginia. He has to form a cabinet by himself, and he has to write an inaugural address. Now, we all remember the image of Lincoln as the beleaguered man, pushed around by office seekers who were at his ankles all the time. In my book, I'm going to say that I think he loved that part of his job. This is what he was elected for, to fill these 1,500 jobs. I think it's a myth that he found it a burden, at least a burden he couldn't endure, because these were the rewards that he was ready to give his political party that they'd been fighting for this entire 6 years of their life. I also think that we have a myth that's grown up now, and I've had long talks about this with my dear friend Doris Goodwin, and I'm not offering a counter precisely to her argument, but there is one part of her premise that I think I take a little bit of issue with in Team of Rivals. And that was this note that Lincoln went to bed on election night, wrote down a list on a piece of paper about who his cabinet would be, and substantially, that was the cabinet he wound up with. For one thing, I've actually unearthed the original document, which has been misfiled in the Library of Congress, and I don't think it's Lincoln's handwriting. That doesn't mean he didn't dictate it, but I don't think it's his handwriting. The other thing is that for the next 3 months, he asked about 15 people to be in his cabinet who didn't accept. He definitely wanted a real Southerner in his cabinet. He asked members of Congress from the South. He asked people from Virginia, from North Carolina, John Gilmer, people we've never heard of, Kenneth Rayner, Emerson Etheridge, because they turned him down. I think he even thought about Alexander Hamilton Stevens, a Whig from Georgia with whom he'd served in Congress in the 1840s and who ultimately became vice president of the Confederacy when Georgia seceded. He asked all of these people, and then he went on a trip to Chicago and was reunited with his dear old friend Joshua Speed. Some of you may have heard that name, the only close friend he ever had. And he went to Speed's parlor with his wife and Speed's wife. They had a nice reunion. And he went into a separate room and he said, "Speed, what are your pecuniary conditions?" Speed knew what was happening next. He lived in Kentucky in those days. He had actually not voted for his old friend. He had voted for Stephen Douglas, telling you people took politics seriously then. And Speed knew what he was asking, and he stopped him. He said, "Mr. President, I think I know what you're going to ask. I cannot afford to serve in the government." And Lincoln was very disappointed. I think he would have appointed Josh Speed to the cabinet in an instant. And ultimately, he appointed Josh Speed's brother as his attorney general, as his second attorney general in 1864. So I think Lincoln was all over the place with the cabinet. The inaugural address is a whole other story. It's a masterwork. It's a little difficult to talk about that on top of everything else. One of the things I loved writing about in this new book was about the inaugural journey. I think Lincoln was probably the most well-guarded president-elect in history. He had future Civil War generals with him, Bullhead Sumner, who was famous. They called him Bullhead because a bullet would go once hit him in the head and bounced off. So he was a pretty good guy to have around. He had Ephraim Ellsworth from Utica, the great drill master, Zouave drill master, who would later become the first officer killed in the Civil War. He had David Hunter. He had others. It was a big contingent of guards, unheard of in that day. I think I haven't shed new light on that famous Baltimore secret passage that ended his voyage, except to conclude that I think there really was a plot in Baltimore that was worth evading, he got it from two sources, separate, independent sources, that a plot awaited him. The amazing thing that he did that I think was bizarre and probably foolhardy is he left all of those military protectors behind and put himself in the care of Alan Pinkerton, who we all know now as a famous detective. Lincoln didn't know him from Adam. He was a railroad employee, and he's the one who said, I've got a private route, we'll go this way, we'll have a night train to Baltimore, you'll ride in the sleeper car. But what if he wasn't who he said he was? He only took one aide, Ward Hill Lamon. Yes, a big burly guy, but Lincoln wouldn't even let him carry a weapon. He thought it was inappropriate. The amazing thing that Lincoln did in his last days as president-elect, and I'll leave the story here, is that arriving in Washington, having been accused of going through Baltimore in a disguise, he arrived the worst possible moment of his public image at the most important and crucial point of his life. Just when America needed strength, just when the North needed assurance that it had a strong leader who was going to hold fast, Lincoln was portrayed in caricatures as wearing an improbable disguise, a tam, a Scotch cap, a military cloak, to avoid recognition in Baltimore. And the cartoonists had a field day, the newspapermen had a field day. He was attacked viciously. Lincoln did a really brilliant, unsung job of image reclamation, worthy of Mark Penn and Obama's guy and McCain's guy all rolled up into one and add a little bit of Karl Rove for sheer genius. He went to church. He walked the streets. He met the mayor. He spoke to hostile crowds. He took himself to the Supreme Court to come face to face with the Chief Justice, who was his lifelong political opponent, the author of the Dred Scott decision. He walked into Congress unannounced to meet the members of Congress, some of them hostile. He went to the White House unannounced to get the lay of the land and meet the cabinet. And one more thing, he went to Matthew Brady's gallery, just as he had on the day he gave the Cooper Union address. He walked in there in his finest new suit that he had bought in Chicago, brocade and velvet and silk. This was not a country bumpkin. This was a very careful man about his own image. And he sat in the chair, and someone came over and said, Mr. Brady, I'd like you to meet Mr. Lincoln. And Lincoln said, I need no introduction to Mr. Brady. Mr. Brady and the Cooper Union address made me president. And here he is coming full cycle, knowing the best thing he can do for himself is create an image of assurance in times that are going to be very difficult. I'm going to argue in this book, and I hope you will remember it favorably, because there are going to be a lot of books coming out in the next year. You shouldn't ignore all the others. But I'm going to argue that had not Lincoln been a great president-elect, for all of the reasons I've sort of glossed over, not only wouldn't he have been a great president, I'm not sure there would have been a country to preside over. And I think his genius was apparent from the minute he was elected, the balance that he maintained, the writing that he did, the passion that he showed when it was necessary, the reticence he showed when it was required, the acumen about hiring people, keeping everybody off balance, keeping everybody united. I mean, I think he was an absolute political genius, and it was all in evidence during what Henry Adams called the Great Secession Winter. Thank you. Thank you. If you notice I'm not leaving, that's because my host said that we could take questions for a while. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Which library did you find assisted you the most in your research?
Did you all hear the question? Which library assisted me the most in doing my research? Well, the two that were key, because they were absolutely essential, is the new Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, Illinois, because they've got all the stuff. They've got all the city directories. They've got all the newspapers from this period. Not as many as I'd like because they weren't saved. So I had to have access there, and my wife and I did our first research trip that we've ever done together, where she actually did research with me, and we survived, so it was good. Because we knew we were going to have a grandson, so we didn't fight that much. And then the Library of Congress. Absolutely crucial because they have the Abraham Lincoln papers, which is all of the incoming correspondence that Abraham Lincoln received. They're all in these big bound volumes. You're not supposed to look at them anymore. You're supposed to do them online, which anybody can do, and it's really great, actually, or on microfilm. But I begged and pleaded and cajoled and threatened and all of that, and they let me look at the actual documents. And it's unbelievable because, you know, here are the letters that he got, and you can see which ones he opened because he would write little notes on them. And there's something, I just one example. We all know that there was a famous ordinance of secession that was issued in South Carolina, a special edition of the Charleston Mercury. The Union is dissolved. It's in every Civil War book that was ever published. I never realized that Lincoln was sent a copy of it. And he was sent a copy of it by these wise guys from South Carolina who wrote on it, "Greetings from the Palmetto Boys." And then I realized that there was a little obscure reference to the fact that Lincoln's son saw a secession ordinance on Christmas Day and was upset by it. And Lincoln wrote, and Lincoln told him it was a joke. So because of all of these research things, the one in Springfield finding the quote of Roberts and the actual thing in the Library of Congress, you could put the whole story together, that Lincoln opened it at home, that it upset his son, that he said it was a joke, but in fact, he must have realized it was threatening. So those are the two that were the best. But we went to a lot of places, Chicago Historical and lots of places. Yes, sir.
How come we never hear anything about Hannibal Hamlin?
You never asked. How come we never hear anything about Hannibal Hamlin? Well, he was, he was not Lincoln's choice. There was no vice presidential sweepstakes in those days. The convention chose the vice president without ever telling the presidential candidate until 1864, when Lincoln may have influenced the dumping of Hamlin for re-election. He wasn't consulted. Why did they pick him? Because he was from a northeastern state, and they thought it would balance a westerner. Do you think they were acrostics fans? Because you could do Abraham Lin Khan, and Hamlin's name is within the name. I've actually seen campaign posters that they would highlight the name Hamlin within Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln had met him once. I'm sure he was charmed when Hamlin said, "I don't remember when we met," when they finally met again. And it was a rocky relationship at the beginning. Hamlin wrote a letter to him saying, "The congressional elections aren't going so well up here in Maine. I'm afraid we may not do as well as you think." Lincoln wrote him a really tough letter. "You've got to get your act together, basically. We've got to win those, because if you don't win congressional and governor of Maine, we're going to lose the state in the election. And if we lose Maine, we're going to lose the whole country. And the game is up," as he put it. So he made Hamlin get to work. Interesting thing is that Hamlin meets him in Chicago before the inauguration, and Lincoln begins using him as a very close advisor on the issues of cabinet selection and the inaugural address. He meets him again in New York. They travel down together as far as Baltimore when he leaves everybody, Harrisburg, actually. But once he becomes president, there's almost no record of their ever having anything to do with each other. Because in those days, the vice president did not have an office in the West Wing. There was no West Wing. And he was really a creature of the legislature. He was the president of the Senate. And their lives really diverged from the day of the inauguration when Hamlin was sworn in first. It was over. And I point to a letter that Lincoln wrote to his vice president wrote to him in September 1862, congratulating him on the Emancipation Proclamation. Everybody always comments on the fact that Lincoln wrote a famous letter back saying, editorial praise is great, but there are more desertions than ever. The stock market is down. Breath alone, meaning editorial praise, kills no rebels. It's a very tough letter. What I'm astonished by is that the vice president wrote a letter to him from Maine. He wasn't even in town. He was not part of the government. So it's a relationship that foundered. because of tradition. And then in 1864, when the balance that Lincoln required was not a Northeasterner but a former Democrat, they go to Andrew Johnson. And if you have to say what is the biggest mistake Lincoln ever made, it might have been turning to Andrew Johnson, because every president is convinced of his invincibility. And the country suffered for having Johnson. Much more answer than you probably needed, but that's the whole Hamlin story as I see it. But he's a character in my book because I was amazed at how much they had to do with each other until they got to Washington. Yes, in the back. The question is, what would Reconstruction have been like had Lincoln lived? That's one of the three top questions that, in terms of frequency, that I'm asked that question. And, you know, the one caveat is that, you know, who knows? You can read and write and study all, but it's still speculative. But I, you know, I point to the fact that Lincoln had just tremendous political skills. And he was much more capable of managing Congress and reining them in when they got too advanced, and getting money for the war when he needed money, and just was a great manager of the Congress. I don't think there would ever have been an eruption where the Congress impeached the president or any of that. And I also point, and I use this as a point to illustrate Lincoln's sincerity as an emancipator as well. On April 11, 1865, Lincoln appeared at the White House window to give what would be his last public speech, from a window on the second floor. And in that speech, he said something that sounds retrograde today, but was pretty shocking when he said it, and that is, we should consider giving the electoral franchise, give the right to vote, to African Americans, the very intelligent, or those who have served in our ranks. Sounds restrictive, of course, but not then. In the audience was John Wilkes Booth. And he says to his compatriot, that means Negro citizenship. And he didn't use the word Negro, needless to say. That's the last speech he'll ever make. I think that's the kind of Reconstruction Lincoln would have had. He believed very strongly in extending the franchise. And I think we would have, you know, I think if Lincoln had lived through the 1860s, we might not have needed the upheavals of the 1960s. But again, that's because I like the guy and I have faith, but it's all speculative. I think, yes, sir.
Did Lincoln, President Lincoln, display such savvy judgment in selecting the cabinet? Why did he have such a difficult time in selecting a equally superior military leader?
That's a great question. That doesn't go in the top three list because I've never been asked that before, but I better get used to it for the new book. The question was, if he was so brilliant at choosing cabinet officials, why did he have less luck choosing military leaders? Well, there are several reasons, I think, that I can advance. One is that he knew politics like the back of his hand, and he knew nothing about the military. He was a veteran, but as he said, he was a veteran of a lot of bloody battles with mosquitoes during the Black Hawk Indian War. He said he never used his saber, but he bent it once. So, you know, that was his military experience. But he respected it. He revered the military, interestingly. He once said being elected captain of his military unit was the most rewarding political victory, the most rewarding electoral victory of his entire life. But again, he never really mastered it. There's a famous story about Lincoln leading his little unit to a wall, and he didn't know what the command was for scaling a wall. So he said, company dismissed, we will reassemble on the other side of the wall in 10 minutes. Now that's all anecdotal, but the fact is, you've got the fact, A, he doesn't know military affairs, B, he believes he can rely on General Scott, who has saved the electoral vote, saved the inauguration. He did guard the inauguration, too. But General Scott is almost 80 years old. He can barely sit in a horse. He's enormous. You know, he's as tall as Lincoln and getting very sick. And although he came up with a great strategy of the war, which is the blockade, still the brilliant strategic idea of the Union war effort, he was failing. He couldn't lead on campaign. Next point, political generals. When the skirmishes begin, when Fort Sumter is attacked, people organize companies. They're not all West Point people. I mean, we lose half of our West Point veterans to the South, maybe more. I don't know what the count is, but they go south to their states. Not General Scott, thank goodness. Not General Thomas, thank goodness. They're too, for the North, they're too, I have to be careful because when I speak in Virginia, they don't like that. But people organize their own companies and they're generally political people. His old law friend, John McClernand, becomes a commanding general from Illinois. Carl Schurz, his great claim to fame is that he's a leader in the German-American community. He actually became a decent general. The German generals were generally terrible. You also needed some Democratic generals, and you needed Republican generals. You needed to balance it, because he needed to keep the Democrats happy, because it made up at least half of the constituency in the North. With all that, he borrowed books. We have the records of the books he borrowed from the Library of Congress. He borrowed Yomini and all of his books on war strategy. He studied them. And you know, in a couple of years, he was able to issue letters of instruction to Sherman and Sheridan and Grant that are absolutely amazing. And never lost his sense of humor, because when McClellan drove him crazy by liking defensive wars and digging entrenchments more than battles, he would fire off these angry telegrams to McClellan. Finally, McClellan wrote, you may know this story, in exasperation, "We absolutely cannot advance after the Battle of Antietam. I have 147 horses in camp that are sick." They have, and he mentions all these horse diseases that I never heard of. "And of the rest of them, two-thirds are fatigued." And Lincoln writes a famous telegram to him, misspelling the word fatigued. He's not a great speller. "Can you please tell me, will you please pardon me for wondering what your horses have done since the Battle of Antietam that would fatigue anything?" So I think the amazing thing is not that he had trouble, but that he learned, and that he turned, he changed his strategy from conquering cities to conquering armies. He changed from skirmishes to, you know, to what was modern war and devastating war under Grant. He learned. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Simply did not want to pursue a war that became as bloody and deadly as what they were still hoping to reconstruct the Union. And some of their reticence, simply hoping that a fight here and there would allow the Union to reconnect.
Well, you know, I think you make a very good point. His question I don't have to repeat. He's got a great voice. So I think you make a point that the Democratic generals believed in a limited war, certainly limited objectives. And when Lincoln realizes he has to get rid of General McClellan, it's not just because he didn't pursue Robert E. Lee after the Battle of Antietam. It's really because McClellan is coming close to disloyalty after the Emancipation Proclamation is issued, because he says we shouldn't be fighting a war to liberate slaves. We should be fighting a war to bring the states back together. And Lincoln, he's the boss. And eventually he gets apolitical professional generals. Grant wouldn't have voted for Lincoln either in 1860. He didn't have the right to vote in Illinois because he'd been in the army for so long, he said, but he would have voted for Douglas. But they were extremely loyal, and they pursued the war aims that the commander-in-chief set. And I think that's another very good point. I'm going to be much better at this talk once the book comes out because of all your questions, I think. Any others? Oh, yeah, let me do this guy first because he hasn't asked yet. My friend from Madrid, right? Okay. I know we all want to say that he wasn't honest, because he was called himself Honest Abe. And you know, in politics, you do things that you have to do. But he was, and you and I talked before this this lecture about Lincoln's one mistake, maybe not dishonesty, but playing around with his message a little bit. I think the honest appellation comes from his youth. You know, he was the guy that everybody turned to be the judge at wrestling matches, at horse races. He was the one that everybody trusted. He did really, you know, work to pay off a book that had been damaged in the rain. He really did all of those things. It wasn't like the cherry tree. These are real stories and meaningful stories in his life. And he was an absolutely honest lawyer. He knew that that was an oxymoronic term even in those days. He wrote a famous piece of advice, resolve to be an honest lawyer. And if you can't be an honest lawyer, don't be a lawyer, but still be honest. I really believe that. We talked before when this young man asked me a question for his college journalism class about Lincoln's portrayal of the Emancipation Proclamation. I think it did damage to his ultimate historical reputation because he couched it as a military necessity. He couched it with talks about colonization. He made sure that the press wrote that he wasn't interested in the welfare of people of color. And I think he did that because he was very fearful that the society was so racist, so endemically, systemically racist, that it wouldn't sustain him if he issued a proclamation. And I know most of the literature today says he was slow in issuing the proclamation. But when he issued it, he was right in that letter he wrote to Hamlin. The stock market plunged. There were desertions at record numbers. He was attacked around the world for fomenting race war. And in the off-year elections that took place 6 weeks after he issued the preliminary proclamation, the Republican Party was slaughtered. He paid a heavy price for it. So I forgive him a little bit of his dissembling. And I think he learned a lesson from it, actually, because he had a fight for that reputation as a great emancipator, and we're still fighting about it. You had another one. You know, so they like to say that they couldn't. I think there was genuine fear in many localities where slave populations outnumbered free populations of white people. And I think they were right to be afraid. They created this insane system and they thought that they would be punished for it. And ultimately they were, but in a different way. At the same time that there were protests about that system, they were plotting to extend it. So, you know, you talk about Haiti, Lincoln really believed that if he gave in on the slavery issue during the 1860 interregnum, that slavery would go to Cuba, and Cuba would be annexed, and Mexico would be annexed. He was sure that the South was planning to expand the slave empire. But why? I mean, it was there. It was a system that they created that, you know, Lincoln was, that was just one other thing. Lincoln was very careful in his pre-presidential speeches never to condemn Southern white people for adopting slavery in the first place. Continuing, yes. Expanding, yes. He said, and I think he meant it in this way, not that it was a moral relationship with other human beings, but that if we in the North had this climate that the South has, we would have done the same thing. And he was very particular about trying not to condemn them for creating this destructive system for themselves. But in the end, he also firmly believed that the system had to be eradicated because it was dehumanizing, and it was it fought the promise of the Declaration of Independence. Actually, in the one way that President Bush sounds like Abraham Lincoln is the belief that democracy would inspire the world. I think his sense of the world was Europe rather than President Bush's, but he really believed that America could not have a hypocritical system if it wanted its example of democracy, if it wanted the arguments of the Declaration of Independence to be taken seriously around the world. We could talk for hours about that, but that's a shorthand version. Yeah.
How confident was Lincoln heading into Washington as the president-elect?
I'm sorry, how, after, how confident was he?
How confident was he actually versus the president? And as a caveat, how did his class and his country influence him? Did he feel that he was capable?
Okay, that's a very good question. How confident was Lincoln as he enters the presidency? You know, I am humble Abraham Lincoln, he said when he gave his first political speech. There's another example that maybe he wasn't so honest. I don't think there was ever a more unbelievably self-confident person in the history of the presidency. I think he had an enormous ego. I think he had a very sure sense of himself. When he went to Washington, he met for the first time with Charles Sumner. Charles Sumner, the Harvard-educated Boston Brahmin senator who was a living martyr to the cause of anti-slavery. You know, he had been beaten on the Senate floor by Preston Brooks and had been out of the Senate for years and returned debilitated but still fighting. And he meets this guy who he's heard as a country bumpkin, who speaks it with a strange accent, who doesn't comb his hair properly, who wears clothes that don't fit him. He said he spent 1 hour with him, and when he left, he felt he had never been with anyone who had felt himself to be a morally and mentally superior to him. And he immediately captivated Sumner. The first thing he said to Sumner was, you're up there in the world, meaning he was a tall fellow. He said, let's go back to back, because Lincoln believed that all tall people should measure back to back with him so he could establish that he was taller. It was very important to him. Sumner said, I beg your pardon, Mr. President. Surely we should be speaking to each other face to face about the grave crisis that we're facing. And Lincoln found that hysterical. He laughed at him and said, you know, you're my perfect idea of what a bishop would sound like. So through humor and through a sense of, I think he had a sense of his own superiority. And it was probably well placed. Could anybody who was ever in a position of political leadership juggle people the way he did? Could any president write like that man could write? He had the power of communication that is timeless and absolutely brilliant. And Sumner and others fell under his thrall. Small people like McClellan, who didn't have Sumner's intellectual capacity, thought he was the original gorilla, whatever. But, you know, they paid the price. He did. Did Lincoln write about spreading democracy? He did. We give hope to the world that all should have an equal chance, he said. He said, we have to prove that I paraphrase, but we have to prove that the Declaration of Independence is not a hypocrisy. It says all men are created equal. He said it's the question of our sense, our understanding of freedom and the divine right of kings. There have been in opposition forever. One says, you eat the bread that you earn with your own hands. The other says, you make the bread and I'll eat it. He was very, you know, it certainly didn't hurt that a huge part of the Republican Party constituency were immigrants from the great upheavals of 1848 in Europe, all the liberal revolutions and uprisings. But he did talk about it a lot. One other example, Trenton, New Jersey, February 21st, 1861, en route to his inauguration. He sees the Hessian barracks for the first time in Trenton that are still there. His speeches change once he gets to revolutionary territory. Albany, New York City, Trenton, Philadelphia. It just brings out the best in him because he's such a fan of the founding fathers. And he says, seeing them reminded me of this book, and it's the same book that he returned, that he paid for when it got wet, Weems' Life of Washington. There was something that these men fought for, some idea that was bigger than themselves, that all should have an equal chance, everyone in the world. So I think he really did believe in that whole ethos of America lighting the way for the rest of the world. Yes? You know, Ed, the question is, did Lincoln ever comment on the fact that the Founding Fathers also had a little bit of hypocrisy attached to them, specifically Washington and Jefferson, as slave owners? Oddly enough, he never did. Washington was his great hero. He thought Washington was perfect. He said, thinking Washington is perfect gives us hope that perfection is possible in the world. I think he recognized the hypocrisy of Jefferson, but he preferred claiming Jefferson as a hero because he knew it upset the Democrats. When he tried to steal him, he wrote a famous speech to be read in Boston, in which he said, all honor to Jefferson, and he was attacked by the Democratic press. He's ours, how dare he say that? You know, there was a lot of forgiveness about Lincoln, about conditions at a certain time. And I think he really believed that all of those founders, maybe he never said so explicitly about Jefferson, because Jefferson became more and more racist as he got older and wrote more and more, but he really believed that the founders wanted slavery to end. He thought Washington did and proved it by freeing his own slaves at his wife's death, according to his will. He believed that most, you know, again, as he said at Cooper Union, an overwhelming majority of the signers of the Constitution believed that the federal government could regulate slavery and voted against slavery. Later, the Northwest Ordinance, the Missouri Compromise, some of them. Yes, sir. Was Lincoln's personal religion important? That's another one of the top three questions. His personal relationship to God was important. In terms of organized religion, he didn't have any. He was a Baptist as a youngster. He didn't join any church for the rest of his life. His wife was a member of a church in Springfield. He attended church. He read ministers and philosophers. He admired Beecher. He admired ministers in Washington. And increasingly you see in his writings, mostly his private memoranda to himself in Washington, he becomes increasingly convinced that God has willed the war. And I sometimes wonder whether it's just all too big for any man to believe is possible, or whether he just, you know, as a human being, can't bring himself to take responsibility for 600,000 deaths. He has to invoke God. I think his most extraordinary comment on God's will comes in the second inaugural address, when he makes, you know, we all remember that for his very merciful peroration, where he says, with malice toward none, with charity for all, let's bind up the nation's wounds. But in the long, long sentence before that, he says, if every drop of blood drawn with a lash has to be repaid by one drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, let it be said again, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. What he's saying is that God is punishing the North and the South for the sin of slavery. Can you imagine a president in an inaugural address saying we're all being condemned by God for what we've done to tolerate or encourage a national sin? It's an amazing statement. So that's, you know, the great book on Lincoln and religion has not been written yet. People have skirted it, but it's very controversial and it's fascinating. I think I saw one more. Yes, that's the one I saw. Oh, good. He's not paid to ask that question. You may have paid him, I don't know. The bicentennial, talk about the will of God, I sometimes wonder. We went to a nice southern city, Louisville and Hodgenville, Kentucky. Yeah, February can be rainy in Hodgenville and Louisville. And we planned a big concert, and Sam Waterston and I were going to do another version of Lincoln Seen and Heard at a theater that holds 2,000 people. And then we were all going to go to Hodgenville to the log cabin. Laura Bush was to meet us there. And we were going to have the official ceremonies launching the bicentennial. So let's see, what happened? Rain, snow, hail, and an ice storm. Everything but locusts. So it was a very strange event. About 400 hardy souls came to the concert in a theater that holds 2,000. That can be very lonely. And we had to cancel the event at the log cabin because you just couldn't walk on it. It was a solid sheet of ice. So we're going to ignore the message, the divine message. So we have other big events coming up. We have a website called Lincoln200.gov, which lists all of them. They're big events, big national events. There'll be a national poetry reading on Emancipation Day in Washington, September 22nd, run by Dana Gioia, the head of the NEA. November 19th, we're going to unveil the Lincoln Bicentennial coin, which you can all buy and fund other programs in Gettysburg. There's going to be the first of a series of town hall meetings led by our commissioner, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., at Gettysburg on November 20th. And then on February 12th, the actual day of the Bicentennial, a ceremony at the Lincoln Memorial, a joint session of Congress with, we're still deciding on the talent, but it'll, in 1959, there was Carl Sandburg and Frederick March reading the Gettysburg Address. I think probably we'll ask Doris Goodwin to be Carl Sandburg. We'll see who gets to be Frederick March. Liam Neeson is a choice that one might want to transition to because he is going to play Lincoln if Steven Spielberg ever gets his act together. And I spoke to his screenwriter, and there will be a Lincoln film. It may even come out in this bicentennial year because he's a very fast worker, Spielberg is. They may start filming in the winter with Sally Field as Mary Lincoln. It's true that she's older than Mary ever was, and, you know, she'd, but, you know, today's 60 is yesterday's 40, right? And she looks great. And Liam is broader than Lincoln ever was, but he'll do fine. And then the joint session of Congress, then we open a Library of Congress exhibition of Lincoln's original documents that's going to travel all over the country. We're doing a catalog of those documents beautifully scanned with comments by famous Americans. We've assembled the most amazing group of people. Three presidents, one notable absence. I won't say who it is, but it hurts me deeply, I want to tell you. Toni Morrison, John Updike, E.L. Doctorow, Sam Waterston, Liam Neeson, Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner, Mario Cuomo, Newt Gingrich, Henry Louis Gates, some younger poets and writers, Cynthia Ozick, Sven Burkitz, just an amazing array of people, and Doris Goodwin and James McPherson, all the great Lincoln scholars, all having something really fascinating to say about coming in contact with those actual documents and seeing the cross-outs and the dog ears and the tear stains, whatever they are. So I think we're excited about that. And then that night, February 12th, is the reopening of Ford's Theater, which is being reconstructed to become a modern theater and a new museum being built downstairs. They bought the adjacent building for a new accessible lobby with elevators. And there'll be a performance of something that night. I think maybe Civil War the Musical, which is was once a Broadway show and is now touring. All those things, and of course, you mentioned there will be an event in Homer, New York in the spring that has gotten the endorsement of the Bicentennial Commission to remember Francis Carpenter, who did more to create the personal and official image of Abraham Lincoln than any person who ever lived. And I'll talk about that more in 09. And his private secretary, William Osborne Stoddard, who wrote great books about Abraham Lincoln and was a very funny fellow and could get along with Mary Lincoln, which is almost more than I could say about Abraham Lincoln. So check out the website, and I hope to see you all in Homer in the spring. Thank you.